morning. I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order. I believe I saw the Commissioner, so if he can join us. I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order. Commissioner Ines, I know, was in here somewhere. Oh, there he is. We want him. And I think you want to call the Tax, the Property Tax Committee to order.
And I will call the Property Tax Division to order.
Okay, so members, we're having a joint hearing so that the governor's folks don't have to do this all in taxes and do it all again in property taxes. So we're all here today, and we want to hear the governor's supplemental budget proposal. We don't want to hear all the stuff that's not the tax stuff. I know in other committees, people are kind of going all over. We just want the tax stuff. So Commissioner, you know, just, and I haven't had a time to talk with you ahead of time, but we're thinking today and Monday. You know, I'm not sure how this will work because last time we thought a day or two, and I think it was four or five.
I think you're right.
To the point that revenue was sort of asking us to stop asking them to come back. But I think what happened, members kind of, the reason I want to point this out is members sort of forget that we had full-blown hearings on all these things last time because I've heard members say, you know, we never debated the angel credit or we never debated capital or we never debated all these things. And I remind them they were all in the governor's proposal, and in fact, we did. So I just want to, you know, let members know we're trying not to have four or five joint hearings on the governor's supplemental budget. We're hoping kind of today and one more. So, you know, I don't know the best way to get through all this, but we really want to make sure that members understand everything the governor's proposing. So however you want to walk us through it, we're ready.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines from the Department of Revenue. And I think you're right, Madam Chair. I think it was four or five committee hearings. And, of course, Representative Marquardt had committee hearings on the property tax portions of the governor's budget as well. You know, I thought maybe the easiest thing to do is, I think you all have this document here, which is a multi-page summary of the governor's tax provisions. And that might be the easiest thing to step through. Language will be introduced next week, so there will be a bill in front of this committee early part of next week. So we can go into greater detail at that point if you so desire. Hopefully it won't take as long, Madam Chair, because many of these provisions have been proposed in the past. They've been altered, changed, revised, but I think you'll see some similarities from previous governor's budget recommendations before you here. And of course, you know, we've been down the road of LGA, market value credit, and county program aid cuts as well before, but I'll just start on this sheet if that's okay with Madam Chair and the committee.
I think, Commissioner, if it's okay, I'm just looking. It seems like all the business stuff is on sheet one and then property taxes on two. No, continues on. I guess maybe if we could get through all the tax cuts that are not property and then discuss it with everyone and then move to property tax. Maybe that's a better way instead of interrupting you on every one of these items.
Madam Chair, I think that's a good way to bifurcate it.
Okay.
Do the non-property tax related stuff and then we'll have a discussion and move on. So I'll just start on page one of this document. And as you see, the first thing referenced is angel investment credit. And you guys are very familiar, the committee is pretty familiar with this provision. It is in all material respects identical to Representative Dabney, Representative Mahoney's proposal. You know, I wanted to say, and the governor actually wants to say, he appreciates the persistence with his angel investment credit. You know, it's been introduced four or five times by the administration. We really appreciate that Representative Dabney and Mahoney and others, Representative Downey, have continued to work to fine-tune the product. You know, I pulled the first iteration we introduced back in 2000, I think it was four, and the product we had today in front of us is much improved. It's a better piece of legislation. And the governor also wanted to show his appreciation to the chair as well, because he knows, Madam Chair, that it's not your preferred approach. He totally gets that. He respects your opinion on this issue. But he also really appreciates the fact that you and your staff have spent an inordinate amount of time working with us, meeting with us at the staff level and at our level to try to make it a better product. And maybe we can't get you to yes, but maybe we can get you from hell no to okay. You know? So we appreciate your effort on that. He wanted me to communicate that to you. So the angel investment credit, as I said before, it's very comparable to Representative Dabney's proposal. It's 25% credit. We put $5 million in for this current calendar year and then $10 million a year going forward per year, capped amount. I think that may be the only difference between our proposal and the Mahoney and the Dabney proposal. As I said, it's a work in progress. We'll be meeting again tomorrow, I think, with tax staff to work through a few more issues. about more accountability in the proposal, potentially a clawback, and some other things that we're still talking about. So we appreciate your patience on this. The next one is a corporate franchise tax reduction, comparable to what the government proposed before, not quite as ambitious. If you remember, he proposed a 50% reduction in the corporate franchise tax, phased in over 4 years. This is a more modest proposal, 20% reduction in the corporate franchise tax, but it would get us out of the top 10 from a rate perspective. And I think fully phased in, that costs about $150 million a year. The next one is the Minnesota Investment Company Credit, also known as the CAPCO proposal. This is another one the governor has introduced on a couple of different occasions. And once again, I want to say I think we've improved the product over time, and I think we have a proposal in front of you. It's a $100 million pool with an 80% credit. You'd have to be a four-year holding period, so the first cost wouldn't show up until 2014. It'd be $20 million a year for 4 years. And that's targeted at smaller businesses. You have to be under 100 employees. You can't be publicly traded on the stock exchange. You got to have more than 50% of your property and payroll in Minnesota. There's certain businesses that would be prohibited from taking advantage of this credit, for example, in banking and investment and real estate development, those sort of things. It's really targeted at smaller businesses, manufacturing, tech businesses, and it's a credit against insurance companies' premium tax. So that's how it would work. The next one is the research and development credit. This is one we've talked about in the past. The governor's never proposed it, but I know other legislators have proposed increasing. I think Representative Coles had a bill proposed increasing the R&D credit. A good historical footnote is that Minnesota was the first state in the country to actually enact an R&D credit. I think it was 83 or 84. Now 32 states have an R&D credit, and ours is one of the more modest in the country. We're ranked about 22nd out of 32 R&D credits. And so this proposal here would increase, currently it's structured on the first $2 million in investments of 5% credit, and then it steps down to a 2.5% credit after that. We would propose just making a 5% credit across the board, and we would also propose allowing it to be a refundable credit and for pass-through entities, smaller businesses to be eligible for the R&D credit. Currently, you got to be a C-Corp to take advantage of the R&D credit. We thought we would expand the universe of businesses that could claim the credit, and since many of those small businesses are just starting out and have R&D functions, don't have any taxable income, we thought making it refundable would help them derive a benefit from this R&D credit. This was also a recommendation of the 21st Century Tax Reform Commission. The next two, Texi and Carzy, are the new generation of Jobs E, I would say. I got Bob Isaacson and Mark Loftus from the Department of Employment and Economic Development in the room. They're the primary architects of these proposals, and they can talk about it in more detail if you have questions. But it is essentially a refined version of Jobs E, Texi is. The major material difference is that it would also be available for metro businesses. It would be a shorter duration. The current program is 10 years in duration. This would be a 5 year if it was metro, 10 years if it was non-metro. And it's been a little bit of an adjustment in the portfolio of tax credits that are available. And Bob and Mark, we can talk about that if the committee, I'm sure the committee will have questions. CAR-Z is more narrowly tailored. A proposal that is fashioned to address the Ford plant issue in St. Paul. We don't know when the Ford plant is going to maybe potentially be mothballed. There's been talk about the Ranger for many years now, talk about the Ranger going away and them finding another use for that piece of property. I know the administration, the governor himself, have been in contact with Ford to potentially pursue other options at that site, potentially an electric car, some other things. And so in response to that, the governor thought it was important for us to put something on the table to show what our level of interest is in retaining those high-quality jobs here in Minnesota. It's an important employer, not only from St. Paul, but from Minnesota. So that's the CAR-Z proposal. Turn over to the next page, and the top one there is an income tax reduction. And this is another proposal that was recommended by the 21st Century Tax Reform Commission. And it would essentially provide a tax reduction, 20% tax reduction, for business income that is derived from pass-through entities. So we got the corporate reduction on the front page, 20% reduction in the rate. This is kind of the comparable reduction for businesses that are organized as pass-through entities. So if you're an S-Corp, a partnership, an LLC, an LLP, you would be able to take advantage of this tax reduction if you had active business income. The next one, capital gains exemption, is very, is identical in all respects with what the governor recommended last year. The only change is, instead of 50% capital gains exclusion, this is 100% capital gains exclusion. Once again, it has to be an investment in a small business, under 100 employees, once again, majority of the property and payroll in Minnesota. There's a five-year holding period in place, so you wouldn't be able to derive the tax benefit unless you held the asset for 5 years. The next one, you guys are very familiar with, this is the federal tax conformity Haiti relief bill, and the governor may have signed this into law. It's the Haiti portion of this, and the Haiti portion is the only portion that has any fiscal impact. The next one, the charter school property tax exemption, this has been Madam Chair, do you want me to take care of the charter school property tax thing or wait?
Yes, with that. We're going to throw it into the property tax bucket. Okay. Maybe just keep going.
Okay. The next two provisions are, one's a fee that we're recommending. Currently, we have a lot of folks who want to do a voluntary payment plan. And the IRS has a voluntary payment plan fee. So if you want to enter into a long-term payment plan, there's a fee at the IRS level of $50 to $110, I believe. We're asking for the legislature to consider a comparable fee at a lower rate, $25. If you're going to set up a long-term plan and negotiate a long-term plan, there's costs associated with that. This $25 certainly doesn't cover the entire cost, additional costs that we incur setting up a voluntary payment plan for a taxpayer, but it does defray some of those costs. And we think that'll raise about $630 a year. And I think we have about 25,000 taxpayers a year who enter into the voluntary kind of long-term payment plans that we have to monitor and continue to audit. The next one is also another issue that's arisen on audit. And this is a penalty for taxpayers who refuse after repeated requests in writing to provide documentation that's imperative to conducting the audit. And so what often happens is that an auditor has to make an audit assessment without all the best information. They make repeated requests to the taxpayer to turn over certain information. Those requests, they're not responsive to those requests. We assess. They, more often than not, will administratively appeal. And then during the administrative appeal, they come up with all the documentation. So we end up conducting multiple, basically a second audit. And this would just say after a written request, and if you can't show reasonable cause for not providing the information, we could levy a penalty of up to 25% of the amount of the tax that's ultimately owed. So there's a reasonable cause exception. They can show that there's reasonable cause. There would be no penalty levied. But we think we found this is becoming more and more of a strategy, and that they'll basically not be responsive to an audit request. They'll go to administrative appeals. They'll come with all the audit information we requested months and months and months ago. They'll conduct another additional audit. Essentially reach the same result that we would have reached. They've just been more responsive in the first place. Other times, it ends up being litigated at the task force level, and then that information comes to light. So we just want to streamline the audit process to the best of our ability. And when we request information that we believe is imperative to conducting an accurate audit, that taxpayer is responsive. So that's, I think that, Madam Chair, I think that concludes the non-taxpayer related provisions of the government.
Okay, Commissioner, we have six people on the list. But before that, we have an important announcement from Representative Anderson, and I want to say that Representative Zellers wishes he could be here, but he is out of the room at the moment. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today with us, we have the ninth grade class from the Heritage Christian Academy, which is in the Maple Grove area. And I know, being the representative from the Plymouth area, I know I have some constituents that attend that academy as well. We just want to welcome you here today. I hope that this process has inspired you to take a closer look at politics. But I also want to mention to you that in our packets today, I think we had some information included in here that might be of interest to you. We have been discussing the issue of taxing iTunes and your cell phones and things that you download into your digital equipment. I'm wondering if any of them would like to comment on that. Madam Chair. Yeah. But no, welcome for coming here today, and I hope that the experience is good for you today.
Welcome. We appreciate you being here. And Representative Zellers just walked in, who's also one of your legislators. So we appreciate you being here. And if you can all think about that offer by Representative Anderson and see if you want to testify by the end here on that, because that is something that We do need to talk about the commissioner with today, and we have revenue estimates members for a decision point that the legislature and the governor is going to have to make as it relates to digital downloads, one way or another, and they have different price tags. And we noted the governor's bill or the governor's budget is silent, and we would like to get the governor's position on this. And so, you know, at some point, Commissioner, we'd like to hear where you might be at on that. And I think members should know that I made a formal request to the commissioner ahead of time so he would know this was coming today, because we are going to have to deal with that digital download sales tax issue on whether we're going to be out of compliance or not, and what the different options are available to us. So, and then one other just housekeeping, Commissioner. When can we see language? I mean, it's going to be, obviously when we get into the property tax piece, it's really hard to understand what you're proposing. But in all of these things, when will the tax committee have the language for the bill?
We will have an actual bill introduced by Monday. We'll meet the deadline, I think. And we can have a copy to you, Madam Chair, and Representative Marquardt today if you want. I think the language has been completed. We'll actually have a copy enrolled.
And I think that would be great, because members, so many of these proposals are, you know, all of you bipartisanly have worked on them. And so you've had bills in these areas, and you want to see what the governor is doing. I just, you know, paging through them, as was mentioned, Angel Investor has been introduced by lots of authors bipartisanly. The corporate tax cut, I've been the chief author of that before. Winkler's got the next one, the Capco. We've had Rosenthal, Bunn, and others do R&D credit bills. In fact, the House Tax Committee proposed doubling the R&D last year and sent that off to the conference committee. And Dabney and Paymar are part of the CARSI. And, you know, it goes on. So I think both sides out have a lot of interest in the actual language and all these provisions. So as soon as we could get that would be really helpful. So thank you.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Ines, I'd like to go back to the Minnesota Business Investment Company Credit, or the CAPCO. Now, remember, we talked a little bit about that last year, but just three questions. First of all, how does that work? Number two, how is that different, or how is it an improvement upon kind of normal venture capital programs or efforts? And then the third question is, do you have a goal for the number of retained and or created jobs that you're hoping to get with that $100 million?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, you know, yeah, we introduced this bill, I think the first time was three or four years ago, and it was about eight or nine states at that point that had enacted something comparable, and it seemed to be yielding some dividends in those states. And the basic mechanism is we make a pool of capital available, $100 million available, I guess you would say, and insurance companies, as long as they invest along the parameters of qualified business, they will derive an 80% credit against their premium tax. Now, one of the requirements is that they don't get that 80% credit immediately. There's a multiple-year holding period. So not only, you know, people have talked, is the 80% credit enough to incent the investment that we're trying to incent? And, you know, I don't have a definitive answer. Some credits, some states have adopted 100% credit. Some have adopted 80% credit. Some have said the credits are immediately available to the insurance company. Some have said, no, there's a lag, so there's a time value of money there that you lose. So we've arrived at 80% looking at what's been adopted around the country, what we think is a reasonable position. And we have winnowed this down as well. I know the 21st Century Tax Reform Commission represents 80% credit to $200 million. I think Senator Bach has a proposal that is maybe $60 million. And this one would have a cost to the state over 4 years of $80 million, $20 million a year. So, you know, one of the things we thought we would do is that these other states who have adopted it have, for the most part, re-upped it, and have increased the amounts. And the evidence seems to be that it's gaining some traction, and it's targeting investment at companies, these smaller companies, that are really struggling to attract that kind of investment. If you look at the language, it really is targeted at small manufacturing companies, small tech companies, small under 100 employees. And I think there may be a limitation on gross receipts annually, too. So it is targeted at those companies. You know, I'd have to talk to Department of Employment and Economic Development if they've run any estimates of what they think that the job creation is going to be over a 5 or 6 year span or longer. If they've done any modeling of that. I know they've done some preliminary modeling of the angel investment credit and what the jobs derived from that would be. They may have run something comparable. I don't know. But I don't have a number, Representative Marco, right now, that we think if we do the $80 million package here, you know, you're going to see a yield, hopefully see a yield of X number of jobs. We just know, I mean, when I was wearing the deed hat for a couple years, I just remember for those small companies, under 200 employees, under 100 employees, boy, their number one challenge was attracting capital, capital investment. I think that's become exacerbated in the most recent capital, you know, the crisis with credit and other things. And so we're just hopeful that we want to pull a couple levers. Do we think it's a silver bullet? Probably, you know, it's not. But is it one lever that may help alleviate some of these small businesses' concerns for attracting capital? It may ultimately, the goal is ultimately grow jobs, obviously, or retain what we got. We're optimistic, and we think the track record in some other states indicates that this does work. And, you know, one of the big questions about this proposal that was raised, and I think it's a very good one, it's a valid question, is accountability. And so I think over time we've strengthened the bill in many respects on some accountability, reporting requirements. Deed has their audit responsibility, certification of the investors, and other things to try to make sure this program is accountable. I mean, this is real money we're sending out, $80 million in tax credits. So I hope, and we're open to more measures to tighten it up, to make it more accountable. But we've worked with advocates, we've worked with legislators to try to, you know, come up with a proposal that we think is accountable but also does something. So.
Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner Reines. How does this differ? How does this improve upon other venture capital efforts? And also, as you look at jobs, and that would be nice to have that number, because I know this bill, I think, is it coming up next, or is at some point. I mean, when we really look at this, it'd be nice to have some numbers based on what's happening in other states or something like that. But, you know, how does this differ from other venture capital efforts, and why is it better than others?
Madam Chair, Representative Marco, I guess, what other efforts, I mean?
Madam Chair, in kind of normal venture capital efforts, these people have to go out and they have to get other investors or other companies or wealthy people or foundations or pensions to give them money to make good investments. And so other venture capitalists have a good track record to get these people to invest in them. Whereas a Capco only needs to convince the legislature to give $100 million. And there isn't this where you need a background of expertise or a proven track record of really creating jobs and so forth. So I'm just wondering what is in the structural foundation of a Capco that would make it better than just a regular venture capital effort.
You know, and Commissioner, I'm going to jump in here because I don't want to get into the incredible detail of this bill because we're scheduled a hearing on it on Monday. So I do want members to, you know, the governor's proposing it, so they have a few questions, but we have a long list. So if we're, you know, I know you were looking at Deed as well,
I was more interested in seeing if Deed had done some kind of benefit.
And Representative Winkler is the chief author of this bill, and members should know on all these provisions the governor's proposing, wherever a legislator proposed them to, we're scheduling them because we want them to have, as chief authors, the opportunity to express themselves on these concepts. But we do want to have some feedback for members for the governors today. But if there's a quick answer from Mr. Cassidy, we'll take it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cassidy with Leonard Street and Denner. We are working with the investment company Enhanced Capital on this very program that they've worked on in other states. Just to fill in a couple blanks real briefly, number one, Deed is doing an analysis on job creation under this program as it's being proposed under Representative Winkler and Senator Saltzman's bill. The other question about, you know, why a Capco and why that kind of venture capital? First of all, I just want to clarify that this kind of capital, we're trying to fill a gap in between the angel capital that you've been talking about for the last couple of years and traditional venture capital, which is much larger numbers, $10, $20, $30 million that you're putting into a company that hopefully is going to go public or become much bigger. There's a gap, a capital gap, in the economy where a company, when it's coming off of the out of the angel stage, if you will, where they're looking for the $500,000, the $1 million, the $1.5 million capital infusion, they can't get there. There's nothing in the market to fill that need. So this is a program that was created probably 10, 12 years ago to fill that need and to incent insurers to participate in it. You're only, under this program, you're only as good as your last program. Insurance companies are conservative by nature. They're not going to participate with an investment company that doesn't have a proven track record, I guarantee you. I think anybody in the room here that works with an insurance company, works for an insurance company, I think I can almost guarantee you that. Unless you've got a proven track record, working with an insurer, investing their money wisely, they're not going to participate in the program.
Okay, and again, we're trying not to get too deep into this, but I have to say, I don't think that was Representative Markworth's question. I think he asked why Capco should receive money from the state as opposed to the traditional methods that venture capitalists don't have an intermediate Capco to get the money. They have to go out now and compete in the market. Why? I mean, if that, I heard the question, I don't think that's what he was asking. You want to take a shot at that one?
Madam Chair, Representative Markworth, yes, I will take a shot at it. And I'll go back to my point earlier, and that is that the market's not meeting that need right now. And there are some instances in the capital markets where the state does have to step in and incent someone, whether it's an investor or an insurance company or someone else, to actually step in to where capital needs are not being met. And that's really the foundation of the program.
Representative Markworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, you know, my understanding, I don't see the insurance companies taking the risk here. I mean, they're getting a credit from the state, which we won't get back. So, I mean, I see the taxpayer taking the risk here in putting out $100 million with no assurances of new job creation or retention. And so that's where the risk is. I mean, the insurance companies, they get the $100 million of the credit, like passed on to the Capcos, who then, and I think this is for a little later date, we can talk about the incentives there. And I think there's some concerns. But I know you don't want to spend a lot of time with this, but I don't know if I'm hearing the answer as to why we still can't go through a proven track record with regular investors who have to convince people based on their good record of creating jobs to invest in them. And there is not that incentive in this plan because the Capcos only need to convince the legislature to give $100 million, and there doesn't have to be a past record of or a real incentive for them to create jobs. I see that as kind of a fundamental flaw here.
Okay, so we are going to have a full hearing on this on Monday.
We should.
And we have six people on the list. Okay. So with that,
thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think a really illustrative conversation in terms of the debate we had just yesterday, why somebody should get money from the state through that. And I just, before I ask my question, just want to reiterate, allowing somebody through a tax credit to hold on to their hard-earned money doesn't mean that the state is giving them money. It means we're allowing them to keep their money. That's a fundamental perspective difference that I'm going to keep bringing up here. The taxpayers aren't putting anything at risk. The businesses who are investing, who could lose everything, are the ones that are taking the risk. So with that, I want to thank the commissioner and the governor for advancing the ball in a pretty substantial way on the 21st Century Tax Reform Commission's report and the variety of proposals that have been percolating around here. And I agree with Chair Lencheski. I think it's become a pretty bipartisan effort. The Small Business Caucus and other groups are putting these bills together. So anyway, I think this is really nice. I think the governor has stepped up in a big way, probably a bolder way than we were even hoping here in the legislature on this. So thank you for that. My question, and this is where maybe I do actually share some sympathies with the chair and others. I'm not a big fan of refundable tax credits because in those cases it does feel like we are actually as a state writing somebody a check whether they've had a successful business operation and realized income or not. And the one proposal that jumped out at me was the R&D tax credit, which is refundable. And I'm curious if you could just maybe explain the rationale for making that refundable and whether there are other provisions in here where maybe it's not specifically called out that are also refundable.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, it's a great question. And we were talking about how we could revamp and supercharge the R&D credit. We'd seen the proposals introduced by the legislators to go to 5% or, we wanted actually to go to 10%. That would have put us in the top 10 once again in R&D credit. We just couldn't get there. The mathematics just didn't work in this particular budget. So we went to 5%, but we also thought, you know what, why should we limit the RNG credits just to C-Corps? There seemed to be another universe of businesses out there that may benefit in some way from having R&D credit. But the rub there is many of these small businesses are just starting out, and just starting out their R&D function don't have any tax liability. And so in really to benefit that small group of businesses, smaller businesses, we thought we really needed to make it refundable for them to get any benefit from it. And I wish I can break down for you. I don't have it in front of me, the revenue estimate here, because I was really surprised how de minimis the revenue impact was by expanding it to non-C-Corps and making it refundable. It's a very small part of this overall cost increase of the credit. I think it's less than $1 million of the cost of that. So it was relatively small, but it also said, you know what, we want R&D in here. We want high-tech jobs. We want these value-added type jobs, whether it's General Mills, Medtronic, 3M, or it's some small startup in someone's garage. I think that was kind of the thought process behind it. But you're right. As a general rule, we probably steer away from refundability. It's a general rule.
I want to apologize to Representative Mullery, who has done a lot of work on this, and a lot of what you just said was in Representative Mullery's bill. So appreciate that. And I had mentioned Representative Bunn and Rosenthal, who have been authors of these provisions, but Representative Mullery has as well. So appreciate that. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Innes, I'm glad to hear we're going to see language early next week. I just want to raise a general concern around the issue of the penalty for failing to provide information. I take no qualms with the department having tools in place to make sure that legitimate audit information requested by the department is provided to the department in a reasonable period of time. But I'm going to just flag now that I'm going to look closely at that language. I want to make sure that while we're giving the department appropriate tools, we're not giving them a sledgehammer to take out a gnat. These are the types of things that can have the unintended consequences of the department, I don't want to be too pejorative, but bullying taxpayers. And I'll speak for myself that I'm going to look very closely at that. And I want to make sure you have the tools. I don't have a problem with the penalty. But I also want to make sure that we aren't tipping the scales too much in favor of the department and against taxpayers in these situations. So, Madam Chair, I just want to make that comment, and I'll look forward to taking a closer look at the language next week.
Okay, thanks. Commissioner, did you want to?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, you know, we share your concerns about, you know, being too heavy-handed in any way, shape, or form. So once the language is introduced, we may want to make sure that you're comfortable with the level of penalty we want to be over-correcting for a problem or using as a bludgeon on taxpayers. Also, you know, we want to make sure you're comfortable with the reasonable cause exception. You know, I mean, you may not want to give the department complete and unfettered discretion on when that comes in place. I would exercise good discretion, but you never know about the next person. You know, but so we understand it, because this stuff, I mean, we thought long and hard before we even brought this to you, because it's become a little bit of a chronic problem and seems like almost be a strategy now about certain intransigent taxpayers. And so we wanted to bring it to your attention, and hopefully we can work out something that draws a fair balance with taxpayers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, looking at these programs, what's going on in states around us, the border, Minnesota, like South Dakota, are they doing some type of work like this to attract businesses, to create jobs?
You know, great question, Representative Detmer, Madam Chair. Anytime we put a budget together like this and decide what our tax portfolio is going to look like for our budget, you know, we do a scan. What's the country doing? What new ideas are out there? And it's not, you know, it used to be, I remember when I first started working around the Capitol, it was the five-state area. You know, what's happening in North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin? Now, of course, our scan includes not only all 50 states, but Malaysia and Germany and everybody else, because it really is a global economy. And, you know, I can just say that 25 states have an angel investment credit. You know, a dozen states now have some sort of capital provision. Our R&D credit, as I said before, is lagging. We're in the bottom third. We were the first in the country to adopt an R&D credit. And we fostered all these great high-tech companies, and now we have one of the most modest tax R&D credits in the country. There are some states that have a 20% R&D credit. Ours is essentially 2%, 2.5%. And so a lot of this is done. It's relatively, where are we relative to our competitors, where is the rest of the world? And so everybody's moving and trying to adjust their tax climate in order to attract as many job opportunities as possible. You know, we had a challenge here because the mathematics of doing a budget when you have a $1.2 billion budget deficit, you don't want to make your tails issue completely untenable. But at the same time, we knew the status quo wasn't acceptable, that we just couldn't continue to have a, you know, the third highest corporate income tax in the industrial world. You know, we're out of whack in the R&D credit. So what we try to do is be very as surgical as we could, but also move the meter and make a difference. And I think the governor said it at his press conference when he rolled this out, is that he wanted to be more ambitious. We ran many scenarios where we did something even more dramatic than this. But it's just, it was challenging in light of the budget challenges. And so we struck a balance between doing something meaningful within the constructs of our budget challenges.
Commissioner, and I had put myself on the list, and now you gave me the best segue, and that is you said we didn't want the tails to be untenable, I think is how you just said it. And I've just passed out something that I requested from Nonpartisan Fiscal today on the tails in this proposal. Mm-hmm. And I hope members will take a minute and look at this. And I think you have one in front of you, I hope. I asked someone to give you one. It looks like this. Can someone give this to the commissioner?
I have.
Okay. You know, I just like before we move to property taxes, and we have a few more questions on this, I want to get up into the big picture of the whole budget here. And I think in looking at the governor's supplemental budget, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, it looks like all the governor's new spending is happening in the tax area. There may be other places he's doing new initiatives and new spending. I'm not aware of them. If they are, that my guess is they're kind of minor. I think in the other finance areas, he's doing straight cuts. In the tax area, he is cutting, and we'll see that in the aids and credits, but he's also spending. And that's why people want to be in the tax committee, because they know that's the one committee where you can both be a finance committee and a revenue committee. You can raise money and spend it all in one committee, or you can raise it for other committees, or you can cut for everyone. And I think, as you know, as already we've gone through, that a number of these proposals have bipartisan support. Representative Downey said that again, and all of that is true. They also all cost money, and we're in a massive deficit. So I asked the nonpartisan staff to try to use the information that's available at this point without language, so we understand there's some problems here where we don't have language. But if members could go over and look at this, where you know, this proposal, the tax proposal, costs us $804 million in the future. So this grows the deficit. It's moving us in the wrong direction. That's my opinion. Okay, so what I want to ask you about, just big picture from the governor's perspective, I think if somebody would like to cut $1.2 billion, and I'd like to make the request now of House Fiscal staff to try to do this for Monday, if a legislator cuts $1.2 billion permanently, is truly a conservative and says, I'm cutting, I'm not using, as the governor's using, one-time money, non-general fund money, and counting congressional revenue infusions, but just does cuts, period. And I think looking at the governor's budget, I think the governor's cutting about $700 million. He's not cutting $1.2 billion. He's counting new spending. He's spending one-time money, and he's using non-general fund money. But if you take somebody else, not the governor, who would say, you know what, I'm just going to step up and cut $1.2 billion for real, you would see not only this tail problem not grow into a big new deficit of $800 million, but dramatically reduce over time. Similarly, if someone said, I'm going to do the real deal here and I'm going to raise 1.2, I'm going to own it, I'm for 1.2 in revenue increases, you'd get the same kind of mathematical situation, I think. And I'd like House Fiscal to provide that for us when we're on this again. To me, I'm having, honestly, a really hard time with what the governor is proposing here, because straight up cuts of $1.2 billion help us get out of this deficit in a permanent way. Straight up revenue does in a permanent way, and I think those are legitimate viewpoints for people to have. What I think the governor is doing is, first of all, he's not cutting $1.2 billion, he's cutting $700 million, and then he's creating a new $800 million cost in the future. So when you net it all out, it's kind of nothing. I mean, that's kind of how I'm seeing it. Within the world of 1.2, it's addressing part of the problem, but bringing a new problem on board for future legislatures and future governors that nets out to the minus of $100 million. I mean, if you kind of track the whole thing through, what we've got is a supplemental budget from the government. It's going to cost us $100 million when all is said and done, and won't solve the 1.2 at all. So I am ready to have you correct me on all of this, But I want members to be aware, is their responsibility as either folks who want to raise or cut, that if you track out these tax incentive initiative proposals at the top of the sheet here now that the governor's proposing, sure, there's a very, we all get how to do this, and it's the tax committee's responsibility to not allow members to do this on either side of the aisle or the governor, where you don't count what it really costs in today's dollars and you stick it out in the future to make it someone else's problem. And as we get more language, we'll be able to verify these things. And the commissioner knows I did this in the tax conference committee last year. Exact same profile. I showed how the Senate did the exact same thing. And the governor did it too. And you know what? The House didn't. The House didn't. It did not, other than doubling the R&D credit, it did not have these growing hundreds of millions of dollars of tails. And I think we just have to be honest about what we're looking at here. And if the governor wants to tell us how he, not here anymore, is going to find $800 million in the future, I'd like to hear about that, because I think the problem we have here is members feel like they have to be the bad guy and oppose these initiatives because they understand that mathematically they grow the deficit. Even members who believe in them. Representative Dabney is carrying a bill on this. Representative Mulery has the R&D credit. You know, you have all these people who believe in these concepts, but when you really see what they do, it's pretty hard to justify how anybody responsibly could grow the deficit at this point in time. And I have to say, I know the argument back, because we have it here all the time. It'll create jobs, and then other people have revenue, and here will come the money. Well, that's a hope and a prayer, but in the meantime, we have to be responsible here, and the advocates of so many of these issues can't demonstrate that. And so, it just becomes really, it's difficult. I understand politically nobody wants to either permanently raise 1.2 or permanently cut 1.2. And I think this is kind of the worst of all scenarios, really. I would rather cut $1.2 billion permanently or raise $1.2 than do this thing where you're cutting some, but you're spending in the future, and you're moving the tails along, and everyone's feeling really good, but no one's really recognizing what's happening in 2015 when we're not here. So, we just fundamentally disagree, but I felt it's important to get it on the record so that the public understands why different people feel different ways about these proposals around here. So, Commissioner, please, your response.
Well, Madam Chair, I know you did this exercise last year with the Senate bill, and I appreciate the even-handedness. But if you buy into, if you accept the premise that the current tax climate is fine and we're competitive and it's acceptable and the status quo is okay, then you probably would have an issue with these tails. But I also would single out the fact that you've included all the things that cost revenue to the general fund. You have not included the things in the governor's tax budget that actually reduce state obligations. And if you layer those over these costs, you would basically have more than self-funded the tax portion of the governor's budget. For example, the governor's recommending not only a $250 million cut of the LGA aids and credits for this year to be extended the out biennium, but also the $200 million that was unallotted. That's a $450 million cost reduction per year in the out biennium. That's $900 million. In 12 and 13. So the $900 million more than cancels out the cost associated with R&D credit, bringing down the corporate tax rate, and those other things. So, in the tax area, he has looked at it in kind of a holistic way and said, I think a higher priority is making our tax climate more competitive than continuing to give aids and credits to local units of government. We're going to have an honest disagreement on that, I think, in this committee. I'm sure we will. But that was the philosophy that he staked out. He said, I'd like to do more, but we got to do something. And so what you see in front of us is his first increment, what he would say would be my first increment. Hopefully the next administration will carry on. But the first increment, making us our tax climate more competitive than it currently is. It just, the status quo in his mind, is this not acceptable? He hears it every day from employers that, we're not competitive in this area X, Y, and Z. We've taken some modest steps, I think, in trying to address some of those things. But if you look at the aids and credits portion of the budget, that fully funds all of these tax reductions that are sitting in front of us now. And he just thinks this is a higher and better use of state resources than market value credit, LGA, county program aid. And we're going to have that discussion. But he set out his priorities, and he also set out the priority that he's going to hold K-12 harmless. And once he made that decision, a lot of this mathematics becomes, a little more problematic. So he made the decision. Some may disagree with that decision. Keep K-12 off the $1.2 billion cut list. And So the budget we came forward was this, under the parameters we had to work with, this is what we came up with. Actually, if he was sitting here right now, he would say this is not nearly enough. And he wished he could do more. But he understands the budgetary dilemma we're in. He understands it. I think this is a reasonable response to that.
Well, and with all due respect, Commissioner, because it's not about, you, but this is the day we're hearing the governor's budget proposal. And I have to challenge that and ask you to please share my views with the governor. If we looked at this in a vacuum, that it's these new tax cuts, spending initiatives for LGA, I'm talking about the whole budget. And I have, as you know, I have a bill that cuts $1.2 billion, and I cut LGA and county aid and everything else, too. I just don't grow the deficit. And for anybody who wants to look it up, go for it. I mean, I cut $200 million out of aids and credits myself, and but I don't increase the deficit $800 million. And I think that this is just, it just makes everyone feel good, and I don't want to put Representative Carlson on the spot, but I see $700 million of permanent solution out of a 1.2 problem, followed with an $800 million unfunded liability for the state. And I'm just not getting how that's fiscally conservative. I, for the life of me, I cannot, no one can explain that to me in a way. I actually think the straight-up conservatives who say shrink government, cut taxes, live within your means, and then actually do it, earn the respect of the citizenry because they've been consistent. And folks who say, I don't want to cut, but I'll raise revenue, I think they do as well. I think this moving everything around is confusing to the public, and people don't understand it, and I think it is not legitimately, the numbers don't play out. So I guess I just want to ask Representative Carlson here, am I wrong in, because I don't follow the total finance side, I thought that the budget proposal that has been put forth, and I sit on the Balanced Budget Committee with you, what I thought Commissioner Hansen said was that permanent cuts of the governor's proposal is only about $700 million. Is that accurate, Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's correct. And if you'll recall, at our last meeting, we spent a lot of time on the $387 million that may or may not come from the federal government. In fact, Senator Pogemiller and I both at that meeting and then followed up with a letter asking for what we called the Plan B, or what I called the Plan B, which was what would you do if that $387 million was not available? And we haven't yet received a response, although I think it's fair to say that Commissioner Hansen wanted to stand with their budget as it was presented, and I view it as a real hole. So you're absolutely correct. There's $700 million in cuts and $500 million that's out there, 387 of which is highly questionable.
And Madam Chair,
to that point,
Representative Carlson, you're right. If you just look at the $1.2 billion, I think what you said is absolutely accurate. $700 million in permanent cuts, the rest of it, FMAP money, Reliance, and those sort of things. But also, this what the governor has presented in front of you today is not just solving the 1.2, but also requests on the legislature. Upon the legislature to ratify the unallotment decisions and make those permanent. So if you were to layer the permanency of the unallotment decision, 2 point whatever it is, and make that permanent, as the governor's requesting, the tail situation improves dramatically. And when I talk about the $450 million aids and credits that's being carried through the out biennium, that's layering on top the unallotment decision and ratifying that and making that permanent. So I think if Commissioner Hansen was here, he would say, we have dramatically improved the tails situation by requesting that the unallotment be made permanent.
Okay, and we're going to go to Representative Carlson and Broad, but I want to be clear on this, because members, this is really for real here. These tax cut proposals, what I'm trying to say here is you could just cut for real something else and pay for them in this biennium, not track out $800 million into the future. If that's the governor's view, cut something else, $800 million, and own it right now. Make the tough decisions right now when you're in office where you have to take money away from people right now and not let someone else solve it, because the governor's own numbers show that he leaves a $2.4 billion deficit on the bottom line. And the unallotment thing, well, that's true, but these are budgeting around, we hope the legislature will confirm my unallotment, or we hope the Congress will give us money. That's not real budgeting in my estimation, and I just think this has to come out here so it doesn't come out on May 10th. we the tax committee members have to think this through really deeply. Representative Carlson and then Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, you just touched on what I was going to point out, is that the governor's own budget leaves the on the bottom line in 12 and 13, $2.4 billion.
And we've got to deal with this, Representative Broad.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this is a good, timely discussion to have. You know, we keep hearing, you know, oftentimes, I guess, we hear about the governor's budget. And I think it's important that we go through the governor's budget in detail. And I appreciate Commissioner Ines being here to do that. But the fact of the matter is that I haven't seen this legislature actually pass the governor's budget yet. And so while it's great to know what the governor is looking at and we'll bring forward that bill and have that discussion, it's also important for us to understand where the House is going to end up in terms of their proposals. And I haven't seen, you know, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of plans for raising taxes. I haven't seen what the proposals are going to be coming from your side. And I think that that's going to be part of this discussion. I hope that those proposals come out sooner rather than later, because I agree with you, Madam Chair. We don't want to be at May 10th trying to figure this out. We did that before, and it didn't work. So I want to get a different direction. But to continue asking the governor to do this, that, and the other is all great and interesting. But unless you're planning on putting a lot of these proposals in your plan, I'm not sure how that gets us from here to there. So the other thing, Madam Chair, I guess I wanted to address is that I appreciate your approach. I think that you do have an honest approach of trying to pay for what you're doing here in the revenue side. I think that that's absolutely, everybody in this room would agree that you go about that. But the bills that came out last year didn't necessarily do that. And so if we want to talk about the governor having a bottom line negative of $800 million in cutting taxes and allowing more people to keep more of their money, and then argue that we shouldn't do that because we're creating a hole, I wanted to remind our members that last year's bills, and it wasn't the tax bill, but last year's bills ended up with $3 billion in spending on the bottom line. The Minnesota miracle wasn't paid for. That passed off the House floor by the majority. It was put off into the out years and said, and it was going to be $3 billion, $4 billion, $5 billion, whatever the liability it was creating to the state was not paid for. And so while I agree that this committee and you, Madam Chair, tend to try to pay for your spending, the House has not done that either. And so whether it was the Minnesota miracle or actually the health bill, I think, had a hole in it as well in terms of what it did in the tails. I think it's clear that even straight-up tax increases don't solve the problem. For those who argue that straight-up tax increases solve the problem, you're wrong. The numbers and the math doesn't work. We've got to couple whatever we do, whether it's allowing more people to keep their own money, which is what the governor's proposing to do and what our side of the aisle would like to do, allowing people to keep more of their money and put it back into the economy rather than spending dollars from the state to move things forward. We want to let them keep more of their own money. But you got to pay for it through spending cuts. And that is what the House has not done. Whether it's the education bill, I think there's a proposal out there to move a Minnesota miracle again forward. Whatever that is, I mean, we do have to have a fundamental recalibration of what government does and what government doesn't do. Because even tax increases aren't going to solve this problem for anybody who argues that they will. It won't. The math just doesn't work. So, Madam Chair, I guess what I'd ask Commissioner Ines is there a way to do some type of dynamic budgeting to show the growth in the economy? Because I think we always argue, and I would argue rightfully so, that allowing people to keep more of their money, allowing encouraging tax cuts in specific and targeted sectors of our economy, actually encourages growth in a way that will provide more money to the state, which will reduce those out-year deficits and reduce them in the right way rather than the short-term way.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, we've had many discussions about the whole issue of dynamic scoring, I think is what it's called, and it tries to build in what is the response, the economic response, if you reduce the tax here, increase the tax there. We don't have that capability at the Department of Revenue. There's a model called the REMI model, which I think Dee utilizes once in a while and others, which tries to model those sort of changes in tax structure or even in, grants and those kind of things. I know that's what they've used, I think, primarily maybe with the Angel Investment Credit and maybe with CAPCO. We have not done it on a more macro scale where we're saying, okay, we reduce the corporate rate by 20% and we do the R&D credit, what is the implications of that from an economic standpoint, the multiplier effect, and just the general response to the economy, those kind of changes. There are people out there that do it. And I remember when I was at the Minnesota Business Partnership, we actually had the Chicago Federal Reserve model single sales portion, and we had an economist down there, a PhD, and model it and see what the job creation would be. And even though it wasn't built into the revenue estimate and we couldn't use it for budgetary purposes, it was an important piece of evidence to have that this is a meaningful tax change that will maybe potentially grow jobs, and here's kind of the economic dynamic that we could create. And I think the tax chairs, both Representative Abrams and it might have been Senator Pogemiller, I think acknowledged, the work that was done by the Federal Reserve, say, you know what, it's not a fiction, it's real. We think this change will motivate investors to do more property and payroll in Minnesota. And so though we couldn't build it in, a handful of states do dynamic scoring. It's rare. It's just, we already have, even doing the static analysis that we do, Representative Broad, it's oftentimes guesswork. And oftentimes our best guess at trying to put a number on a proposal. And I think doing the dynamic scoring adds a whole other layer of uncertainty around that. But it is a useful endeavor to talk about, and it is a useful endeavor in certain proposals to try to do a modeling. And in that one instance with single sales, I think most legislators looked at it and said, that's a peaceful information to have, a useful piece of information to have to make a rational decision. And I think it helped us make the case.
Madam Chair.
And we do want to have this committee understand that modeling, because I'd like to debunk that. I think that's dangerous. And I think we need to get Representative Krinke in here to get people to understand what we're talking about here. I think we are all in denial about the problem ahead of us. We all want things to not cost money, and we're looking for ways to make tax cuts be free or spending be free. And Representative Liebling brought this up in the last meeting. We're going to count behavioral effects on one thing, and we're going to count them on spending too. Because you know what? If you infuse money in the K-12 system, then the deficit will go away. This is, really, I think members have got to get their heads around this, and I don't mean to insult anyone. I think this is not a liberal or conservative message. Legislators are struggling, and they don't want to deal with what they're up against. And we're all trying to find ways to make it not count. And I really hope we'll have that Remy model discussion, and we'll bring in the head of the Taxpayers League, and we'll all talk about what that all means. Because now we're getting into very interesting accounting, and I hope Minnesota never goes down that road. Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, I'll just finish up a little bit. It's interesting to me that we can't ever come up with a system to account for growth in the economy, but we seem to have all these great firm numbers over what government spending is going to do or not do through the bonding proposals and other spending proposals. I find that disparity rather interesting. We have a firm number, the bonding proposal, somebody said is going to create 21,000 jobs. Well, based on what? It's a proposal that has, there can't be any firm number there if you can't create a firm number on the tax cut side of things. And so I think the situation is this, Madam Chair, is that I had an amendment to the bonding bill that said I wanted to count jobs. I wanted to count real jobs. Representative Morrow decided that instead of just talking about the indirect and the direct jobs that we were going to create, we were going to add something into that amendment that was going to count all the extraneous spin-off and things along those lines, and everybody voted for it. I didn't, because I'm not sure how you account for those spin-off projections. But yet, the folks on your side of the aisle voted to change that up and to make it a little bit more muddy. So my question, Madam Chair, is that why is it that there's an ability to count jobs when government spends money, but there's not an ability to count jobs when government allows people to keep more of their own dollars? It's a disparity that I think is interesting.
Well, Representative Ron, I have to say, that's a different topic. We were talking about the numbers, accounting. There's not job totals here. What I'm saying is when you spend money on tax cuts, it costs money. And when you spend money on funding things, it costs money. And both sides show that. What I'm arguing against here is we don't start saying tax incentives don't cost money. They actually make money. And
not do it on the spending side, too. We could do that. And then what we'd find is an infusion, $300 million into the schools or $300 million to health and human would show up plus on the deficit side. No, we have to be doing the same things. This is, we need to get the CPAs in here as well when we talk about this further, because we're now morphing into job counts. I'm talking about counting the dollars on the spreadsheet, and when we infuse money on the spending side, we don't count pluses after. We count minuses. And when we infuse money into spending cuts and tax preferences, we count minuses. And we need to keep doing that. But we're having people arguing, and I've heard it on both sides of the aisle, that we should sort of change, and on one side we should really say it doesn't cost anything. And I just think we need a well-rounded discussion for committee members for the future to really understand, just from a CPA perspective, what we're talking about here. And the rhetoric, of course, happens on the floor. But this is dangerous stuff, members, and the more times I hear people talk about this, I get more and more worried. Representative Rukavina, the commissioner. Representative Rukavina.
Well, maybe I should give you a CPA perspective, Croatian progressive assessment. You know, because I really get, is that CPA? I think it's you know, I've seen all I get to hear the new buzzword over there from my two friends, which is what allowing people to keep more of their money. Did you do some research or to come up with that phrase that you're both using over there? Because, you know, I've been watching for at least 7 years where we're just taking money out of people's pockets a different way. And my property taxes have doubled, and I'm not complaining because I can afford it on this big salary that we get. But, you know, it's happening all over the state, and it's a direct result of what we're doing here. And you can say that cutting, for example, the University of Minnesota and the MinSCU system, what the governor's proposing is about 160, I believe, or 140 million in the base annually coming up, because of Representative Broad's good amendment last year will show what happens in the out years. What's that going to do to people's tuition? Now, we already have a problem coming up with our students in our higher education system that never has been addressed in the governor's budget, and that is the fact that already 8-9 months into this biennium, we have a $42 million hole in the state grant program that we were told the other day for a middle class kid at the University of Minnesota means a $1,900 cut in his grant program. That's not a tax. Is that allowing somebody, a parent, to keep more of their money? Is doubling your property taxes allowing you to keep more of your money? Let's have an honest conversation, which we haven't had around here. You're right. Both of us sides are guilty. You know, we're calling a $5.4 billion deficit, which is really $8 billion in the next biennium, but because, you know, former Majority Leader Moe and former Majority Leader Pawlenty went to using Enron accounting practices, I call them, where you count revenue inflation on the revenue side but not on the spending side, we're really looking at some huge, huge problems. We are. But, you know, I don't want to hear about allowing people to keep more of their money, because we're not. You know, when you take people off of GAMC, and Representative Murphy worked so hard. I had dentists in my office this morning, a few of them from the range, a couple of them from your area, over there, big boy. And, you know, I thought you were Shumper for a minute. I couldn't remember the name. Anyway, you know, your area telling me that they're laying off three people.
What an insult.
He's laying off three people, this dentist, because we're proposing to cut that GAMC from a 38% reimbursement on dental to 19% in the governor's bill. Maybe we should take a look at what the governor's budget proposal is really doing to cost jobs. Because if you cut the university in MinSCU, 160 in the base, and you take away 200 some million dollars on LGA, you're laying people off. You screw around with GAMC and cut it, the doctors and the dentists aren't going to throw those people in the street. You know, one of the proposals of GAMC is no reimbursement for anesthesia for pulling mentally ill and mentally handicapped people's teeth out. So the dentist said, give us money up front. Give me a pair of vice grips. Let me stand on the governor's shoulders and pull just one tooth out. One. And we'll see if he proposes, commissioner, pulling people's teeth out without anesthesia. You know,
This is what's going on in the state. We're all to blame. We're all sitting around arguing with each other, and we have to have an honest conversation. And the honest conversation, members, is, you know, we've got to raise some revenue. I don't care how you do it, what gimmicks you use. We already have a governor that's used a gimmick called a cigarette fee, which for 100 years was a tax. We called it a fee. You know, we're just not being honest here. And our proposal, Representative Broad, at least said, we'll cut $2 billion. We'll play with the funny money from Washington for a couple years and count that as $2 billion. Figure out what to do with that, and then we'll raise $2 billion in revenue.
Madam Chair.
And it's a question of whether we raise it, you know, through property taxes or tuition fees or making people pay that don't have any money for anesthesia up front or whatever we do. You know, again, I'm a CPA, Croatian Progressive Assessment here, and that is go back to just a fair income tax again. Because when we cut that income tax in 1999 and 2000, we just kept building up a loss of revenue of about $1.8 billion a biennium. And then we took over Representative Downey's and a few other people, my cousin, we come from the same village in Croatia. So I wonder if the Croatian Progressive Assessment is the same as mine. How did that happen?
Madam Chair, if I could just respond.
People started getting money to the tune of $2 billion a year in transportation levy takeover. We never paid for any of it. So let's have a real honest assessment, and let's talk about really keeping people, allowing them to keep more of their money, because we're not allowing them to keep more of their money. We're just taking money from the different pocket from them. That's what we're doing right now.
Okay. Madam Chair, I just want to respond.
I could be next, but just
thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, I'm really pleased to hear you want to tax fairly, because then I hope that you're going to support my flat tax proposal, which gets us moving in that direction. But I mean, fundamentally, Representative Rukavina, even if you raise the income taxes, the direction that you're wanting to raise the income taxes on small business owners, for the most part, 70% of those folks are small business owners. If you want to raise taxes on the highest bracket, you are not going to be able to solve the problem and solve the budget deficit that you're trying to solve. The math doesn't work. And then what you do is you end up harming our economy and the jobs that are actually provided by those folks when they reinvest in our communities. And so I guess I don't understand the math on how you can continue, how we can continue as a state making promises to people that we know can't be kept because the numbers aren't there in the state budget down the road. Through an income tax increase, the math just doesn't work. You know, part of the problem is that we've been making promises to people that we know we can't pay for, whether it's 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago, 8 years ago, under both Republican and Democratic leadership. We punted on the issues, and we moved our spending into the out years so that somebody else would take care of it. And that's part of the reason we brought that amendment forward in the past couple of years, and so we can start shining a light on making those tough decisions today. But we've got to make the tough decisions. There is no opportunity for us to continue making promises, whether it's on the healthcare side, whether it's on the education side. Representative Greiling has another Minnesota miracle of $2 to $5 billion worth of expenditures that she's promising to the people of this state. How are you going to pay for it? There's all sorts of great things that we want to do, but you can't pay for it through an income tax increase. The math just doesn't work.
Okay, Commissioner, and Representative Broad, that same critique that Representative Broad just made applies to the governor's budget. Identical. Chair, not paying for
if
it.
If I can correct
Representative Rukavina, waiting for the commissioner here to jump in.
Commissioner gets paid $108,000. He can sit and listen for a while.
Representative, in fact, he can pay
our
taxes. But Representative Broad, I haven't been one to talk about taxing the higher brackets. I've been one to talk about taxing income tax fairly, and that's all income. I had a surcharge, like a great governor by the name of Al Quie agreed to, when he's the only one here that stayed here until New Year's Day, when that governor realized he couldn't keep a no new tax pledge, and that's what this is all about. It's no new taxes that I get blamed for, but it's new taxes for a lot of people from county and city government in this room in Paris that they're going to get blamed for. I haven't proposed to tax the rich. although they can pay a little more than their fair share. I propose taxing, putting a surcharge to get us out of this mess, and then growing jobs, and then growing jobs. And I haven't talked about a new Minnesota miracle because there was nothing wrong with the old Minnesota miracle. You guys changed it and gave school districts that have a huge amount of property wealth, including Representative Downey's over there, where his dad's a good swim coach and good friends with an Iron Ranger by the name of Willard Eichel, who's probably a good Democrat, but that's a whole I regret. You know?
He's not my endorsement.
I know. Well, yeah. Occasionally, you know, Finns are very quiet. They don't like to say no. But anyway, you know. But anyway, you know, let's get back. And so, you spend money. We spent money. We voted the cut. I didn't vote for income tax cuts. I never did. And it's a mess now. And I don't know where we got this idea that we can run government and we can have schools and we can have higher education and we can take care of vulnerable people without having some taxes. I don't know where that came from. I just don't know where that came from. If our parents, my parents' generation, those great Americans that are all dying off now, you know, they fought so hard to give. My grandparents came here with nothing. They were serfs in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You know, my Italian side could read a little bit. The Croatian side couldn't even read. Look at how smart we turned out. But anyway, if they hadn't fought to give us a better living, and they all agreed to pay tax. My dad spent 2.5 years on the front in Germany with my uncle Milan. My uncle Joey was there and I was Iwo Jima when they put that flag up. They came home and they became teachers and they talked about paying taxes and giving the next generation, you know, something more than they had. And here all of us are sitting. We're going to be the first damn generation in the history of the world in this country to give our kids less than we gave them. We're saddling, you guys sit on that committee with me, we're saddling our kids in higher ed with so much debt they'll never get out of it. You can't run government without some taxes, and we better all pull our heads together and start working together instead of trying to figure out who's going to be in charge of this place 2 years from now and doing this and doing that. Because that's all we do. You know, I'm getting a little just disgusted with the whole thing that, you know, hearing the new buzzword now, allowing people to keep more of their money. I'll be honest about it. I'm going to take a little bit of money from everybody that got a job, because if they got a job, they can afford to pay a little bit. But when you unlock and let a guy take $2.7 billion away from people, you lay off nurses and teachers, and you lay off people that take care of my mother and dad and took care of in that nursing home for next to nothing. That's the jobs we're costing. I want to know what a $2.7 billion unallotment cost in jobs. If we're going to talk about growing jobs, let's talk about the jobs we lost or will lose by saddling this state with a $2.7 billion unallotment. Just off the top of the board, and that dentist that was there in my office from your district this morning laying off 3 workers because he can't get any reimbursements from us anymore. So let's have an honest conversation. Madam Chair, did I take care of business?
Commissioner. Commissioner.
You should run for hire.
Commissioner, and then Loeffler, Marquardt, Gardner, and Demmer.
Madam Chair, that dentist is not from my district. He's from Lewiston, North.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to set the record straight about this dynamic scoring. I am not. I don't have a response to Representative Rukavina.
And Commissioner, I appreciate your smiling right now.
Yeah.
Before I even say this, because, you know, this is rough, and I'm sorry for that. I do think hearing Representative Broad and Rukavina and me, and it is better what we're talking about.
It really is.
I mean,
Madam Chair,
we all have to face this stuff and get it out of our system so we can work together. So,
Madam Chair, we're all adults. You know, these are important decisions that have to be made. There's strong opinions on both sides. It's not a problem. I did want to clarify, though, about the dynamic scoring discussion we had, because I'm not advocating that we should change the methodology and start doing dynamic scoring for these numbers here, but I think Representative Broad makes a very good point that there seems to be a double standard about when that kind of math is appropriate and when it's not appropriate. I'm not saying we should change the way we do our revenue estimates, but, you know, you hear, the one I always think about is Dr. Art Rollman. I mean, a great economist. He comes around here and makes a very persuasive case about the return on investment for early childhood learning has an 8-to-1, you know, return on investment. The legislature never really challenges those kind of discussions that a public dollar spent in early childhood learning is going to get an ROI of, you know, many multiples. But whenever somebody raises the same discussion point on the tax side of the equation, we're looked at as extra, you know, engaging in voodoo economics or something that just is totally out there in left field. And I think there's a double standard in that respect. So I hear the jobs talk, like Representative Broad said on the bonding bill, it's going to be X number of jobs. That's worth talking about. If you guys have, you know, some math out there that comes to that conclusion, that should be on the table. But we shouldn't just be so dismissive about the consequences and the benefits of a spending reduction as well. And I think that's the point Representative
And I appreciate that clarification. And we don't book it on the spending side. When people make those 8-to-1 arguments on early childhood, they don't show up on a spreadsheet. And what I'm saying is, and neither should we reverse it on the tax side. We're good how we are, but if we're going to bring in one dynamic, we've got to bring in it on the other side. So I appreciate that clarification. I think we're in the same place there. But
Madam Chair, I think you know this, Madam Chair, but there is one revenue estimate I know we do at the Revenue Department that we do take into behavioral effects, and that's the cigarette tax.
Yeah.
When we increase the cigarette tax, we build in elasticity to that.
Yep.
So there's an exception to the general rule, and we do build in change in behavior based on those taxes. So it's not completely beyond the pale.
Right. I appreciate that. Representative Loeffler, then Marquardt, then Gardner. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, yesterday we ran out of time, so I couldn't highlight it. But I know I saw some of you put your tax expenditure report in the save part of your folder. And Dr. Wilson did a great job yesterday. But what really struck me is how many pages. And if you just riffle through that, the tax expenditures that double over a four-year period. There's an amazing number of them. They're disproportionately, not exclusively, in this economic development area. And I suspect a lot of them, and it goes back to kind of what the chairman pointed out, I'm sure that they passed on lines like this, the Minnesota Business Investment Company credit. The commissioner described it as an $80 million tax cut, but when we look at our sheet, it's zero, 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 and zero.
Right.
The rate of growth in Job-Z and a lot of these things are exponential at a time when our state economist and our state demographer are telling us we are going to be hitting a real flat period of any kind of economic growth, no matter how many seed capital things we invest in, just because the demographics are working against us and there's only so many smart ideas in the universe and all the states are competing for them. And so I would really like for these long-term investments, and most of these investments in new company startups are long-term, to see a 10-year projection. We're accused all the time of thinking short-term, and yet we know it's not just a short-term problem that we're facing. It's a long-term one with the baby boomers retiring, our income taxes falling off as a result of things that we can't change. People grow old, no matter who's in charge of the legislature or the governor's office. And we have to start thinking in this committee, I think, with that kind of long-term payback. And maybe we don't have the kind of dynamic modeling that everybody can have confidence in, but we've had Job-Z for quite a long time. Our state auditor looked at it. It didn't create a lot of new jobs as much as it moved a lot of jobs around. And yet we bought it as really going to be starting new businesses to get off the ground and do well. I would challenge you, Commissioner, to work with Deed and give us from that real investment, how much new unduplicated growth that we wouldn't have ever anticipated otherwise has resulted from that. Because I don't think we should expand it to Texas, even though I'd love to see those tax breaks in my community that the metro area hasn't had, and the CARZ and the, you know, all these other credits. I mean, let's at least look at what we can, where we've got real numbers in Minnesota and where there has been more than just moving from one place to another. And some of those has created real jobs, but it's 5 or 6 or 7. And these are hundreds of millions of dollars when you add them up. And we got to have a lot more than 5 or 6 or 7 jobs for every major investment to make this pay. And so I really hope that you'll join us and come back with a 10-year payback spreadsheet and whatever data you can put together out of your department on the Job-Z forgiveness, what the projections are for the ones that we've already done, and what the payback's been, because I think that's how we have to evaluate this long term.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the Commissioner's candor. And he said that the business tax initiatives are paid for by cuts to property tax aids and credits. That's basically what you said. And so, you know, I have heard a number of times where allow people to keep more of their own dollars, and yet the governor's own plan will increase property taxes by about $291 million in fiscal year 2012 and cut renter's credit by about $143 on the average to senior citizens and those with disabilities. That's not keeping more dollars in people's pockets. And I was taken to task by Representative Dowling for asking some questions about Capco. But my point is, if we're going to take $100 million from property tax aids and credit and put it into economic development, I'm going to ask some tough questions before I take money away from senior citizens on fixed incomes who are using those dollars that could be lost to stay in their homes, families who use that money to get to school and work after a 6-inch snowstorm, money that's used for flood prevention and getting prepared for floods that could occur in the Red River Valley. I'm going to ask some tough questions about those programs if that $100 million is coming out of another area. So these programs have to work. We can't just give $100 million because it sounds good.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to put my gravity boots on so we can come out of orbit here a little bit. First, I just want to say, I think, documenting things on the spending side of jobs is a good thing. I thought Representative Broad's amendment was a good idea, and Representative Winkler and I have had legislation to ask for the applying entities to provide the data so that we can compare apples to apples. And it's a little bit easier when you're working on a micro-level project where a MinSCU can ask a contractor, how much is it going to cost to replace the roof, and they calculate how many carpenters and roofers and so on. That's a little bit easier. So we could get that data ahead of time and instead of worrying about doing it later. But I wanted to ask the commissioner on the REMI model. Maybe he can confirm what we heard from Dr. Wilson yesterday and confirm his comments today. And that is, for some either tax expenditures or tax cuts or spending, it is possible in isolation to perhaps look at what the number of permanent jobs is, the induced jobs of people who have a percentage of something that feeds into a full-time job. But because the a cut in taxes of corporate franchise rate or small businesses they interact with too many other things for us to be able to come up with a number. And I could think, for example, on if we're trying to keep a competitive tax rate, we're not necessarily creating jobs and reducing some kind of taxes. We might in some cases, but we shift. So, the angel investor credit's talking about keeping jobs from going to Wisconsin. There are other things where we could promote growth where someone has an idea and a thing in their garage that they can build, and suddenly in 2 years they've got 100 employees. Those are the kinds of things that I think we're interested in seeing adding more value to the economy over time. I don't know that we have a handle on just how dynamic all those interactions are. I don't think we want to do stuff just to shift around jobs. We want to create jobs. But if the commissioner could just confirm that we can't really calculate accurate numbers on jobs created through some of these things because there's so many interactions among lots of different variables. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, almost everything I know about the REMI model I learned from Dr. Wilson, so I'm not going to contradict anything he says on the issue. I do know that there's probably some more sophisticated modeling in other parts of the country that's gone on at different universities that may try to get to that issue exactly, but that is the deficiency at the REMI models that we've worked with in the past, is that it's hard to isolate the effects of especially multiple changes, and particularly with tax changes. Oftentimes the REMI model has been used to, if we do an economic development project of X size, what is the induced job benefit? What's the ancillary economic benefit? What's the multiplier effect? When you start modeling tax changes, I think it becomes much more complicated.
Madam Chair, I would also assume that it's also hard depending on what time you're at. I mean, 2 years ago, we could have made some assumptions to go into a model that don't apply now for other reasons. And we can also quantify things like the workforce and infrastructure and other things like that to figure out how they plug in. So I guess I'm just encouraging everybody to keep pushing to figure out how to explain the benefit we get from making changes on the tax side. Dr. Wilson said on the expenditure side, you can't add them all up and come up with a number because there's interaction between them. But if if we can't explain it to taxpayers in 30 seconds, I think we're all in trouble, no matter what side of the aisle you're on. So if we can figure out how to do that, Madam Chair, in the coming months, I think that would be really helpful.
Thank you. Everybody save your stuff, because the commissioner's coming back on Monday, and we'll finish. Thank you.